VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Syria's future is uncertain after rebels seized the capital, Damascus, and President Bashar Assad fled to Russia following 13 years of civil war and a half century of his family's brutal rule. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports.
Syrians awoke Monday free from the brutal Assad family dictatorship that had governed the country for 50 years. A lightning campaign by Syrian rebel forces in recent weeks and the rapid collapse of government forces culminated in President Bashar al-Assad and his family fleeing to Russia over the weekend. Amid the celebrations, regional and global powers moved to secure their interests and settle scores in the war-torn country. U.S. jets attacked what Washington said were Syrian targets associated with the Islamic State militant group. The Kremlin said it planned to discuss the future of Russian military bases in Syria with the country's new rulers.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. Israel has seized control of a demilitarized buffer zone in the Golan Heights and attacked weapons factories near Damascus following the overthrow of Assad. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Sar said Israel is concerned that some of Syria's weapons could fall into the hands of those who want to harm the Jewish state. For decades, the boundary between Israel and Syria had been Israel's quietest border following an agreement after the 1973 Yom Kippur War. But some analysts say that the new situation could eventually lead to a peace treaty between Israel and Syria. Israel is watching to see how Iran will react to the events in Syria. Some in Israel fear that Iran could try to reestablish deterrence by moving ahead with its nuclear program, which could spark an Israeli attack on Iran. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made the case on Monday for a diplomatic settlement to Russia's war in Ukraine and raised the idea of foreign troops being deployed in his country until it could join the NATO military alliance. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan has more.
Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky opened the door to negotiations with Russia on Monday as he sent the latest signal for a potential diplomatic settlement to end Russia's war in the country. The remarks came at a joint press conference with German opposition leader Friedrich Merz. Zelensky also returned to an idea raised in February about the possibility of European nations sending troops to Ukraine. There was no consensus on the matter among European leaders. Zelensky added, Ukraine must have a clear understanding of when it will join the EU and receive an invitation into NATO. Kyiv has insisted it needs security guarantees to prevent Russia launching another invasion once the current hostilities are halted.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. TikTok and its China-based owner ByteDance asked a U.S. appeals court Monday to temporarily block a law that would force a sale of the short video app in the U.S. by early next year or face an unprecedented ban. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen reports.
The companies filed an emergency motion with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, pending a review by the U.S. Supreme Court. Last week, a three-judge panel of the appeals court upheld the law, jeopardizing the future of the app, which is used by 170 million Americans. Lawyers for the company said the prospect the Supreme Court will take the case and reverse is sufficiently high to warrant the temporary pause needed to create time for further deliberation. The law to force a sale or ban TikTok was driven by widespread worries among U.S. lawmakers that China could access Americans' data or surveil them with the app. TikTok has denied it has or ever would share U.S. user data. Also, TikTok and ByteDance have called the law unconstitutional and a violation of Americans' free speech rights.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. New York police said on Monday a strong person of interest in the killing of an American healthcare executive has been arrested. United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson died in a dawn ambush Wednesday as he walked to the company's annual investor conference from his hotel. Court documents say police found a black 3D printed pistol and a 3D printed silencer in the 26-year-old suspect's backpack. He has been charged with weapons, forgery, and other charges. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 10, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former President John Dramani Mahama is officially named winner of Ghana's December 7 elections.
As things stand now, President-elect John Mahama has slightly over 56.6% of the vote against former Vice President Mohamedou Bawumia, who has 41.6% of the vote.
The Uganda Law Council rejects Martha Karua's application for a special certificate to practice law in defense of opposition leader Dr. Chisa Beseji. There's more chaos in the Liberian House of Representatives with allegations of a death threat. Climate change battle Seychelles takes part in a case at the International Court of Justice. And today is UN Human Rights Day.
Human rights are about people. They're about you and your life, your needs and wants and fears, your hopes for the present and the future.
How Trump and Biden shape the courts comparing their judicial achievements. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Elections Commission of Ghana has officially announced former President John Dramani Mahama of the opposition National Democratic Congress, the NDC party, as the winner of the December 7 election. VOA's Paul Ndiho is in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, covering the vote. He tells me that the president-elect addressed his supporters at a big rally on Monday evening.
As far as the Electoral Commission is concerned, there are some constituencies that haven't been able to be counted. But from what the chairperson of the Electoral Commission said, those results would not alter the difference or make any difference when it came to announcing President-elect John Dramani Mahama as the president-elect. So as things stand now, President-elect John Mahama has slightly over 56.6% of the vote against former Vice President Mohamedou Bawumia, who has 41.6% of the vote. It was a low turnout compared to the previous elections, but at least as they registered about 60% of the voters voted in this election.
So the president-elect John Dramani Mahama has been speaking to Ghanaians. Any idea what he said?
Absolutely. I just came back from that rally he had at his office. Very electrifying, a very excited crowd. It was one of those things that he was looking forward to. Remember, he has contested against the current president, Nana Akufo-Addo, two times and lost. So this was one of those rallies where his supporters, he told his supporters, thanked them, those who stood by him, he thanked his family, he thanked every single person who has been a part of this long journey. It's been 8 years of him trying and trying and trying. Finally, God helped him.
Of course, now the task is dealing with the demands of the electorate, the economy. I guess Ghanaians will have to wait to see what's going to happen.
I think he has an uphill battle. For sure, the economy is not doing great. You have a lot of young, excited people who are waiting for change, who are waiting for some of these promises that were promised during the election to be implemented. And I kid you not, this could be one of those things where 100 days into office, 6 months into office, young people are getting onto the street saying that our politicians haven't changed because they overwhelmingly voted for the idea that he's going to bring about jobs when he talks about the 24-hour economy, that he's going to, in a way, change the direction of this country economically, politically, and socially. So a lot of eyes are on how he handles himself going forward. People who voted massively across the entire country for him, they want to see change that is immediate, not something that is far-fetched, but something that is tangible. They want to see tangible results in the immediate. As John Mahama was giving his victory speech, he talked about how the current president, Nana Akufo-Addo, extended an olive branch and invited him to Jubilee House. And they're going to have a transition meeting this Wednesday.
That's VOA's Paul Ndiho speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra, where he is covering Saturday's presidential and parliamentary election. Liberia's ruling Unity Party is denying any connection to allegations by the embattled Speaker of the House of Representatives that someone has threatened his life. According to local media, Speaker J. Fonati Kofa's office alleged on Sunday that someone has sent him a threatening message warning him to resign. Meanwhile, there was chaos on Monday between the two sides in a dispute about the speakership of the House of Representatives, prompting the National Police to intervene. Speaker Kofa's side accused the police of siding with the group that wants to unseat him. Luther Tappe is the national chairperson of the ruling Unity Party. He tells me that the party is a peace-loving institution that believes in coexistence.
It's unfortunate that Honorable Kofa is insinuating that someone from the Unity Party is making such deadly threat on his life. Unity Party, as a very responsible and peace-loving political institution, would never dive into those kinds of maneuvering. It is something that I can categorically say as the chairman of the party that we are making absolutely no threat on his life. The Unity Party have demonstrated that we want to give everyone the opportunity to participate and build a country. So it's an outright allegation that we would not condone. Unity Party is a party that never gets involved in wish hunting its political opponent. In fact, the president traveled with Speaker Kofa then to Rome to see the Pope. These are all clear indications that Unity Party does not believe in a matter of one party wins the election, that party alone rules the country. We've demonstrated that we want to walk across party line and move the country forward.
There were police officers on Capitol Hill on Monday, and now there is this claim that the ruling party or the government is supporting the other side by sending police against Speaker Kofa's supporters.
Well, James, look, the government role is always to protect lives and property. And so whenever there's a clamoring of disagreement in every sector of the governing process, it is the responsibility of the executive to ensure that law and order is applied. And the police has the national responsibility to ensure that laws and orders are the order of the day, no matter the institution, no matter the sector. And so if there is pandemonium in the House of Representatives where they are at each other's throats, of course it's incumbent upon the government to send the national police to maintain laws and order. And that's what the government did. That should not be misconstrued as its support to the majority bloc.
What is the feeling in the ruling Unity Party about this entire dispute in the House of Representatives?
From the get-go, we have been very clear. I was able to speak on behalf of the party on the ELBC National Radio, calling on both sides to iron out their differences and do the work of the Liberian people. We are all aware that the pandemonium in the House of Representatives is delaying the developmental process and agenda of our country. And we have always told them that it is important to go back to their rules and resolve this thing amicably so that they can do the Liberian job. And our position on that has not shifted. This thing has lingered for several weeks now. And it's important when Kofa is no longer, he does not enjoy the support of his colleagues, he needs to step down so that the Liberian people work will be done. This is not about personal interest. It's about the country.
That was Luther Tappe, the national chairperson of the ruling Unity Party of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 10. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Uganda Law Council has rejected the application of former Kenyan Justice Minister Martha Karua for a special certificate to practice law in Uganda. Karua has been appointed to lead a team of lawyers to defend Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye and his co-accused. According to Dr. Besigye's wife, he was kidnapped in Kenya and brought back to Uganda. He and another defendant are charged in a military court with unlawful possession of ammunition and a firearm. Karua tells me that the denial will not deter her and the rest of Dr. Besigye's defense team. In fact, she said she will continue to appear in court as an observer.
It is not for the Law Council of Uganda to determine what value, as lead counsel, I will add to Dr. Besigye and Mr. Lutale's case. The Constitution of Uganda clearly gives them a right to counsel of choice, and their choice is that I lead the team. By asking what value I will add, they clearly were violating the Constitution of Uganda. Ironically, on the International Human Rights Day, the angry tone they have adopted in their letter of response clearly shows that the reasons for which they have made their determination are extraneous. They've also raised several extraneous matters which are not part of the legal considerations for grant of a license.
What does this mean for the defense team of Dr. Besigye?
Dr. Besigye's team is undeterred, as I am. I will continue to appear in court, even though I have no right of audience, as an observer. And today, I accompanied the Lord Mayor Erias Lukwago, who is one of the lawyers for Dr. Besigye, to Ruzila Prison. We saw them, and we agreed that we continue to push for their rights through the various forums. I will continue to mobilize Pan-African lawyers to come and be observers, and those who are from the Commonwealth will apply for licenses. We should not limit the right of Dr. Besigye and his colleague, Ms. Lutale. We must continue to push the boundaries. With the treatment, the rough treatment I got from the Law Council and their tone, which undermines the appearance of impartiality, one wonders whether Dr. Besigye and Mr. Lutale are likely to get justice in a military tribunal normally meant for discipline for military people, as opposed to him being tried as a civilian in a court of law. Not to mention the matter of the Supreme Court, under the leadership of the Chief Justice, keeping a ruling that would clear the air on whether civilians can be tried in a military court, delaying that ruling for over 3 years, almost 4 years.
Martha Karua is the leader of Dr. Kizza Besigye's defense team, and she was speaking with me from Kampala, Uganda. Millions of people are stuck in poverty, hunger, and poor health, and education systems that have not yet fully recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic. This is according to the United Nations, which also says that human rights are under attack. As the world marks Human Rights Day today, Tuesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says it is important to protect, defend, and uphold all rights. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
This year's theme for Human Rights Day is Our Rights, Our Future Right Now, demonstrating how human rights affect people across the world daily. A report by the United Nations indicates that human rights are under threat in conflict and crisis settings where violence and forced displacement occur. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the UN works to support human rights solutions that strengthen accountability, protect communities, and foster peace.
Global inequalities are running rampant and conflicts are intensifying. International law is willfully ignored. Authoritarianism is on the march while civic space is shrinking. Hateful rhetoric is fueling discrimination, division, and outright violence. And women's rights continue to be rolled back in law and practice. This year's theme reminds us that human rights are about building the future right now.
In Africa, the UN partners with national human rights institutions to help tackle violations. The United Nations Development Programme says local initiatives are key when it comes to addressing the issue. In troubled countries like Somalia, where women and girls' rights are violated, the UN says women are being supported to lead peace efforts, including assisting those facing violence, discrimination, and injustice. Guterres says the recently adopted Pact for the Future reinforced the world's commitment to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
All human rights are indivisible, whether economic, social, civic, cultural, or political. When one right is undermined, all rights are undermined. We must stand up for all rights, always. Healing divisions and building peace, tackling the scourges of poverty and hunger, ensuring health care and education for all, advancing justice and equality for women, girls and minorities, standing up for democracy, press freedom and workers' rights, promoting the right to a safe, clean, healthy and sustainable environment, and defending human rights defenders as they carry out their vital work.
On the other hand, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, says by adhering to a common set of values and principles, human rights help to avoid violations, conflict and abuses before they happen.
Today, as we mark Human Rights Day, I want to focus on what our rights mean. Human rights are about people. They are about you and your life, your needs and wants and fears, your hopes for the present and the future. A safe home, food and clean water, healthcare, education, decent work and a livable minimum wage, to live in peace, to be free to express your opinion. These are your human rights. They are about who we are and how we live.
According to a report by the Human Rights Watch, African governments were faced with threatening war crimes and humanitarian crisis throughout 2023 with inadequate international assistance. The group says unaddressed historical injustices have led to widespread violation of human rights against civilians in the region. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
The Seychelles, a small island nation of the east coast of Africa, is among the countries participating in a climate change hearing taking place through December 13 at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, Netherlands. Kate Butler visited the main island, Mahé, to see how residents there are coping with rising sea levels and a warm ocean.
There may be plenty of fish today at this market in Victoria, the capital of the Seychelles, but veteran fisherman Cliff Morrell says that's not always the case.
Sometimes we go, we don't get enough fish because of climate change. The temperature is very hot. And then the fish need to go far in the deep sea.
Charlize Federia manages this dive center on Mahé, the main island in this archipelago off Africa's east coast. She has seen firsthand how global warming has affected the creatures in this part of the Indian Ocean.
Literally, and I mean that, almost crying underwater because I was like, where's the sharks? Where's the stingrays? Where's everything? I'm seeing nothing.
She also says the changes to the coral have been drastic during her lifetime.
When I started diving, there was a coral bleaching, but it gets so much worse now. Although we have seen that corals grow faster than we think, it's still not fast enough to adapt with the changing sea temperatures.
Flavien Joubert is the Seychelles Minister for Agriculture, Climate Change and Environment.
We've had several warming events. Every time you have a warming event, your reef collapses, the living coral dies, and then it comes back, but it doesn't come back to the same level.
Another phenomenon, higher than usual rainfall, causing flooding and landslides. Heavy rains destroyed this home outside Victoria last year. Several people died. The heavy rainfall also threatens the egg viability of the Aldabra giant tortoises native to the Seychelles. These land tortoises are also facing the threats of warmer weather, habitat loss, and rising sea levels. One of the biggest challenges here. Sea levels around the Seychelles are rising about 3 millimeters per year, says Environment Minister Flavien Joubert. President Wavell Ramkalawan says people will eventually be displaced.
We face the brunt of the climate crisis. Some of our coral islands might disappear. And along the coast of the granitic islands, where most of the population live, we will have to move to higher ground.
Joubert says larger countries bear the most responsibility for climate-related events and should help smaller nations deal with the effects.
There are those with more resources and who have emitted a lot more and who have benefited from those emissions who should actually step in and step up their game and really put more resources on the table to help countries like us in adapting and mitigating emissions.
In the meantime, the government has been rehabilitating coral reefs and pushing for more renewable energy use, hoping that such measures will help sustain the livelihoods of the people and creatures who call the Seychelles 115 islands home. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Mahé, Seychelles.
Namibia's main opposition party filed papers with the Electoral Court on Monday. The French news agency AFP reports that the party is demanding access to tally lists for all ballots cast and counted in last month's vote, as the results will likely be legally challenged. The Independent Patriots for Change IPC party has already said it would not recognize the results of the election that was controversially extended twice after logistical and technical problems meant some people did not vote on November 27. The Council of European Union on Monday renewed EU sanctions on the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, for another year, extending them until December 12, 2025. It said in a statement, Reuters said the measures targeted 23 individuals and one entity linked to human rights violations, electoral interference, and ongoing conflict. Those designated face asset freeze, and individuals are also subject to travel bans. President Joe Biden is making last-ditch effort to appoint more federal judges before he leaves the White House. But where does he stand on appointments compared to President-elect Donald Trump?
Some of the most consequential people shaping the future of the United States are its federal judges. More than 1,700 work in America's district courts, courts of appeal, and the Supreme Court, hearing cases involving the Constitution and federal laws. These lifetime appointments don't just hear cases, though. They define rights, policies, and freedoms affecting millions of Americans. Take, for example, the five Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, reversing a decades-old ruling on access to abortion. Or U.S. District Judge Roger Benitez, who, in 2023, reignited debates about gun control by ruling that California's ban on assault weapons was unconstitutional. Federal judges are appointed by the president, providing him an opportunity to define America's legal landscape while leaving a lasting legacy. These appointments must be approved by the Senate, something that is much easier when the chamber is controlled by the president's own party, as it is now. Biden is now in the final months of his presidency, known as a lame duck period that starts once a successor has been elected. It's often hard to get things done during this time, but the outgoing president is pushing to appoint as many judges as possible before the Senate adjourns for the year. So how do Biden's appointments shape up compared to Trump's? When Trump was first in office, he oversaw the appointment of 234 judges who were later confirmed by the Senate. These include three Supreme Court justices, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, tipping the country's top court heavily to the right. Under Biden, 221 federal judges have so far been confirmed, including the Supreme Court's first black woman, Ketanji Brown Jackson. Almost two-thirds of Biden's appointments have been women, and he's made significant efforts to appoint judges from racial and ethnic minorities. There are currently 40 outstanding vacancies in the federal judiciary and 12 pending nominations awaiting Senate confirmation. Democrats recently brokered a deal with Republicans to try and fast-track the Senate review of a handful of federal judge appointments. But the chamber may not have time to surpass the 14 federal bench appointments approved during Trump's own lame duck session in 2020. In many ways, America's courts are a final battleground between Trump's and Biden's contrasting ideologies. The final word on everything from abortion rights and gun reforms to capital punishment and the environment may rest in their hands.
And That's it for this Tuesday, December 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butter in Washington, saying thank you for listening.